Welcome to David Clark's We Are Superman podcast, episode number 290. I am your host, Bill Stahl. In a little bit of a twist, I'm chatting today with another podcaster, Joe Corcione from the Everyday Ultra podcast. Joe is a fellow New Yorker who also cheers for and often suffers with my same New York teams, the Giants, Yankees, Rangers, and Knicks. The Everyday Ultra podcast is laser-focused on the ultra-running world with one of the best lineups of guests to keep the ultra aficionados informed and entertained. Joe also presents episodes that provide excellent tips and guidance to your everyman and everywoman ultra-runner. What is incredibly impressive, though, is that Joe grew up as a self-described non-athlete who eventually developed a serious drinking problem. When Joe hit his breaking point, he moved west, eventually landing in Arizona, and he began a running career and jumped in with both feet, pun intended. Like most starting out, his journey began with baby steps, and Joe began to rise rapidly in his challenges to become an ultra runner and is now training for the Cocodona 250. Not only that, but he has built a successful coaching business, and Everyday Ultra is a top-ranked podcast, all of this occurring in a mere 5 years. As you'll find out here, although Joe is relatively new to ultra running, he can also dispense some amazing insights and wisdom for a young guy. I definitely recommend you check out the Everyday Ultra podcast, where you will always feel Joe's unbridled enthusiasm for the sport, and above all, his desire to make a difference to help every ultra runner get better. And hey, if your running motivation is also flagging in this rough winter for many of those of you in the U.S., UESCA certified coach Mickey McConaughey and I have begun the Be Positive Runners community. Mickey and I will provide you customized personal workouts on the Training Peaks app, and we will have group online calls where we can share experiences, tips, and provide encouragement to one another. Hopefully, this will develop into group trips to goal races. We will initially limit the community to 10 motivated individuals who want to help themselves and others knock out their 2024 goals. If interested, shoot me a message at silly_billy@msn.com or on Facebook or Instagram messengers, and we can talk to see if you would like to be a Be Positive runner to achieve more in 2024. Or mention it to a friend who you think could use this kind of positive community. Okay, now here is Joe Corcione and me. Hey, good morning, Joe.
Good morning, Bill. How's it going, man?
It's going good. You know, we got Colorado sunshine popping up here and, another day in paradise.
I love it. I love it. Yeah, I love Colorado. It is so awesome. I live in Arizona, so a very different climate over here. But man, I've been to Colorado a handful of times and it is just so special. And, you know, I have the privilege to be racing there this summer too, which is awesome. And wanting to really get out there a little bit more because it's relatively close to Arizona and I haven't been there too much, but yeah, I'm living vicariously through you with those beautiful mountains out there for sure. And I'm not a cold person, but like if I were to move somewhere cold, it would be Boulder or, you know, Colorado Springs or Fort Collins, any one of those like kind of mountain and areas for sure. So I'll live vicariously through you.
Well, thanks. Well, Arizona sounds pretty good right now. Although we've had some warm weather here in Colorado this winter, it's not like people think. We are actually heading into our worst months, believe it or not. March and April is when we get all our snow typically, although it's supposed to snow here this weekend. So who knows?
Oh man, well, I'm hoping for, I don't know, you might like snow, some people like it. I personally don't like snow as much, but I'm hoping it's a great winter for you, my friend.
Yeah, well, thanks. Well, you know, we can talk about the sunshine and everything from our perspective, being New Yorkers who, I was just back in Jersey last weekend and I didn't see the sun for 4 days. And they said, oh yeah, we haven't seen the sun in 3 weeks. And it's like, there's a reason we got the hell out of there, right?
Exactly. Yeah, I know. And I think that's like a big thing that I always encourage anyone, and like I know it definitely gets more difficult when you have ties back in the place that you live, like whether it's like family or school systems or friends and things like that. But one of like the biggest transformations of my life was, and even just my mental health, was moving to a different environment that best suited me. And you know, I grew up in New York, and you know, where I grew up in New York was, I mean, it was great. Like there is like good access to trails and things like that, but you know, I felt like the running community wasn't lacking. You can really only run outside and, you know, decent weather for a fraction of a year, where, you know, moving to a place like Arizona where the running community is beautiful and you get to pretty much run all year round, albeit the summer's a little hot, but you can still run around outside without having to bundle up or be freezing. And that was one of the biggest shifts, just not only in my life, but, you know, in the pursuit of like my running career and my goals and everything. So like, I truly believe it's like, if you need a big change in your life when you feel stagnant, like changing your environment, aka where you live, or even just going on like an elongated trip somewhere, can truly, you know, change your perspective for sure.
Yeah, the summers are a little hot in Arizona, huh?
Just a tad, you know. It's so funny, because when I was going to move to Arizona, I moved from Wisconsin, so like polar opposites. And people were telling me, they're like, oh, it's like pretty hot in the summer. And I was like, yeah, like past like 90 degrees, like how much different can it be? And yeah, being here for 4 years now, I can say, oh yeah, it is. You can definitely feel it when it's above 90 for sure.
Oh, yeah. That's why cooking instructions say, you know, there's a big difference between 300 and 350. You know, it's like,
exactly.
Different exactly. things happen, and one is bake and the other is broil, or, you know, something. Yep. I don't know.
Great analogy.
Yeah, no, but yeah, I'm not sure if I could handle Arizona heat that well. I mean, I like the cold. So Colorado's great. You know, running in New York was tough. You know, I'm not sure how much into running you were back then as opposed to now, but the roads weren't built for pedestrians, you know, foot traffic in mind. I mean, the roads were narrow, they were windy, they had no shoulders, and people like didn't want to give you the road either. I mean, it was, you always felt the aggression of New Yorkers when you're trying to run. It's like, you don't belong here, you know?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And I started my running journey in New York for a very, very short time, but I would say, like, honestly, it was the first, geez, like maybe 4 to 6 months in my running career. And granted, I did start in the summer, but in like the last like kind of 3 months where I was really starting it, that's where it was getting colder, it was getting a little bit more sketchier with like ice on the roads. And yeah, where I lived, like there really was no sidewalks. Like you did have to go on the road. Luckily, I had like a paved trail that was like right outside my house, which I didn't put two and two together that I could run on that for like the longest time. So I was running on the shoulder of the roads and doing all this crazy stuff. And then even so, when I moved to Wisconsin, I mean, it was a similar deal where, you know, you can run on trails, but they're very icy. It's snowed over. It's super cold. Like it's really, I don't want to say tough, because I still got in the miles and I still got in pretty good training out there in the winter. But it's just like, for someone like me who just very much loves the trails and I get so much of an energy from it, it did definitely weigh on my kind of just way I not viewed running, but like excitement around running. Like, you know, you wake up in the morning at like, you know, Saturday for like the fifth Saturday in a row when it's like below zero outside and you're like, oh, like it's pitch black. It's just like you bundle up, you're wearing all these layers, and it got old after a while, at least for me. And then like now in Arizona, it's nice. Like most days you can just pop on a t-shirt and shorts and go out there, and it's like you rarely have to check the weather, and it's just amazing. And so that's allowed me to really just love running so much more.
Yeah. So is that why you chose Arizona? Because obviously if you're looking to run trails, you could have chosen Washington State or Oregon or Montana or not North Dakota, but Utah, whatever. But is that pretty much you just looking for the heat?
Yeah. So when I moved to Arizona, I was kind of in a place where, you know, I'd never lived at somewhere that had like relatively warm weather all year round. Right now, I guess like you wouldn't consider Arizona summers warm. They're extremely hot, but like I'd never experienced a place like that. And I actually looked around to different places. I looked around to Los Angeles. I looked around, even like Southern Utah. I've looked around at like various different places, Florida, like the South, like all that kind of stuff as well, to try and see like which place that I really liked. And, when I went to Arizona, I just like fell in love with the beauty. Now, when I visited, it was in March, so it was like
peak
temperature and weather. But I just love the terrain, the landscape. And like the thing that I really like about Phoenix, and I think a lot of people don't realize, is like there are so many trails, like actual trails, like not like just these like greenway trails and things like that, like that are just like paved, but like trails inside the city, like, which is like super, super cool. So like I live in the city, I live in a very urban environment, but 10 minutes away in the middle of the city, like I can be in the mountains, which is just so rad. And so I just love that like ease of accessibility. Whereas like if you're in like LA or, you know, a lot of these other areas, you kind of got to drive outside of the city to really get in those kind of mountains. And so like for me, I do like being in a very larger kind of environment for sure. So it was a kind of mix of factors. The weather was definitely a role for sure. I knew I didn't want to live somewhere cold, but like ease of accessibility to trails. There's so many of the premier trail races here in Arizona, and it was relatively affordable compared to like LA and all these other kind of places as well. So yeah, Arizona got like really the bid for me in the end of the day. If I could live anywhere though, if I'm being honest, Bill, like I would live in Flagstaff, Arizona, mostly just because the altitude and like I have a lot more running friends in Flagstaff than I do in Phoenix, kind of shockingly. And so I would live there, but me and my wife, we both agreed to live in Phoenix. So she likes it here better. And I mean, I love it here in Phoenix. It's not like I'm, you know, compromising by any means. So I would live in Flagstaff. I would sacrifice a little bit of the cold weather for it, just for the community. Cause like that to me has become a lot more important than just the warm weather, so to say.
Yeah, no, they've become a kind of a mini Boulder these days in terms of the running community up there. I mean, obviously they've got the Hoka group that's up there, and I'm trying to remember the name of it. Northern Arizona something. I forget what they call themselves, but yeah, no, it's a thriving community up there. So it would be cool, but they get snow. They get their altitude's pretty similar to Denver, I think, isn't it?
I think it's a little higher. So like they're usually sitting around like 7,000 feet ish, I believe, like 6,000, 7,000. So they're a little higher too. And it's nice because some of those peaks you can get up to like 8,000-9,000 feet of elevation gain, which is just, or of elevation where you're at, which is super, super cool. So, I mean, I love going up there to train, especially in the summer, because like you not only escape the heat out here, but you also get the benefit of like the altitude training, which is super cool. And I think that's like such a rad thing about Arizona too, is like people just think it's like desert and cacti and saguaros and really hot heat, but like Flagstaff, you go there, it's a mountain town. It's like, it's beautiful. It's up high. It snows, like you said. And it's got a lot of diversity in there too, which is like why I get super stoked for training for a race like Hokodona, which, you know, is in a few months. Like that, what drew me to that race, besides the difference, is like I consider that race like an ode to Arizona, where it's like you literally start in the desert where it's like super, super hot. You go through the Red Rocks of Sedona. You go through all these like historical towns in Arizona, and then you finish in Flagstaff, which could potentially have snow at the ground like at the end of the finish. So it's just such a cool, diverse thing, which, you know, makes me just love Arizona so much, because it's like if you want the cold weather, you can get it. If you want, you know, the good weather in the winter, you can get it. If you want beautiful Red Rock terrain, you can get it. And it's like, I know it sounds like I'm just kind of preaching the drum in Arizona, but like I really truly think, and I truly think that if you're a runner, like I would say, like race in Arizona, visit Arizona, run in Arizona. It is just like, I think it's a must run place for runners, like not just in the US, but I would say even the world.
Yeah. No, that's really pretty awesome down there. I had an interesting experience down there probably about 5 years ago where, I mean, my impression of Arizona always was just exactly what you described earlier. I've taken cross-country teams I've coached down to the Nike Regional, and it's been on a boring, flat golf course. It's just an artificial thing popped up out of the desert, and it seemed like everything around there was just shopping malls and sprawl, and just to me it was like, this is kind of disgusting down here. Well, several years back a buddy of mine says, hey, you want to come down to Arizona, run this marathon with me? And it was right before the start of track season. I always like to kind of get away because I know for track season I'm going to be stuck here going, you know, just nonstop for 7 days a week. And so it was called the Lost Dutchman Marathon. Mm-hmm. And I mean, literally, he called me up 3 weeks before. I had not trained for a marathon at all. I mean, my longest run all winter had been 10 miles. But I said, what the hell? Basically, they bussed us up from Apache Junction out into the desert. And it was beautiful running down that canyon there. I think the first 9 miles or so were just in this desert canyon, which I had no idea how beautiful that could be. I just always thought it was just going to be a wasteland. And very nice. So, and I had a great race too. So it was a good trip.
That's awesome. And that's like a great area to run. Like, I mean, it's very well known to like people in the area who like live here, like that Apache Junction Superstition Wilderness is what it's called, which is super, super cool. But like those trails, even, you know, they're well known to a lot of people in the area, but they're not really run on too much. But like, they're so cool. They're so rad. They're extremely technical when you got to get out there too. And even if you're just like on the roads, just going out there, I mean, it's a great place to do like engagement pictures, which we did ours over there. And like, it's just a beautiful scenery. So it's like, just like another thing of Arizona, of just like why it's just so rad. It's like all these like unique areas, even besides just like the, you know, Camelback Mountains and Sedona's and even, you know, the most popular Grand Canyon, which by the way, I freaking love the Grand Canyon. That's not to be a belittling comment. Like that is, it never gets old running in there. Yeah, there's just so much to offer in the state, which is so cool.
Yeah, no, definitely. Well, before we get into kind of the meat of things here, I'll ask you one fluff question of sorts in that, being the New Yorker in Phoenix, have you found any good pizza down there?
Oh man. Yeah. So I'm a pizza connoisseur. Like I literally on my phone have like a ranking of like every pizza place. Like I've tried, like right. No joke. Like I'm very much a pizza guy. And by the way, like anytime before a race or a long run, I will eat pizza the night before all the time. Like, and I have not changed that in years. It's always worked for me. I've never gotten sick. Like I've always usually, you know, felt pretty good the next day. And so, I'm a very big pizza guy. There is some decent pizza here, but you know, it cannot touch New York. There's one place that has like New York style, like big slices, very much kind of just like traditional New York. It's good, but good for Arizona. And yeah, I mean, there's good pizza here, but I cannot find anything even remotely close to New York. And every time I go back to New York, which I was just there this past Christmas, yeah, it's just,
no,
it's incomparable. So like if anyone thinks that they've had good pizza and haven't been to New York, like go to New York and your taste buds will be changed. But you got to make sure you go to a good place too, because there is a lot of crap places in New York. But yeah, I found some decent pizza here. If anyone's curious, like who's listening in the area or going to Arizona, my favorite pizza place in Arizona is Il Bosco Pizzeria. It's an artisan Italian place. Super, super good. Ask for the pizza. Well done. And it's probably the closest to New York you'll get.
Okay. You Phoenix listeners there, you got your recommendation there from an expert. So that's
yes.
Good. Yeah, no, if you ever make it up to Colorado, Joe, I will take you to Anthony's. I'm there before every University of Denver hockey game I go to. And even my mom, when she was out here, and they now live in Savannah, Georgia, and they're like, can we get Anthony's out in Savannah? And I'm like, well, yeah, I think you're going to have to open it up yourself because, you know, it's just here. But, you know, big slices, everybody, the pies come out and people literally, they're all gasping about it. And here's the funny thing. I have this unique, I mean, I'm just a scrawny runner guy. I can eat pizza beyond anybody's wildest dreams. I've eaten one of those large Anthony's pizza myself.
Oh, that is awesome.
Yeah. I mean, they actually brought it out and they asked me, are you sure you know what you're doing here? It's like, oh yeah, no, it's...
You're like, don't question me. I'm from New York. I got this.
Yeah, no, I got this funny thing. I can just eat so much pizza. I actually once won a pizza eating contest with another kid I used to coach. But that's a whole nother story. But I'll tell you a couple other quick running and pizza stories, though. I was running the Leadville 100, and they'd helicoptered pizza up to the Hopeless Aid Station. And
whoa.
I said, I'm not going to pass up pizza. It's ridden in a helicopter. So
yeah,
so yeah,
it's got to be the best pizza ever.
Yeah, like, exactly.
I mean, even if it doesn't taste great, the fact that it traveled by helicopter, yeah, you got to take it.
Yeah, so I was eating pizza during the Leadville 100 that time, and then another race here in Colorado, the Quad Rock. It's a funny course where you end up at the same aid station over and over and over. And they were cooking up the best tasting bacon there, you know, and that was, I'm a vegetarian now, but back then that, you know, bacon can be really good in a race, as you may know. Yeah. And, I was back of the pack and I got up to the aid station the last time. I said, man, all I've been thinking about is just getting up to this bacon here again. And they go, well, we're out. I go, you're out. I said, that just crushed me. They said, but we do have pizza here. And so the rest of the race was basically downhill. And I was literally flying down this hill with a slice in each hand and munching pizza out of both hands as I'm running down this hill. It would have been a beautiful video.
Oh, that is awesome. The pizza handhelds. That is incredible. Oh, my gosh. That is so freaking awesome. I love, like, the pizza race stories. And I'll share one with you real quick that was, like, from recent, which I thought was awesome. So I ran Javelina 100 this year. And like, for some reason, I really had, like, a hard time getting down specific nutrition, which is not, like, you know, a oddity in an ultra marathon. If you've kind of been there, it happens. Like, you just sometimes your body just doesn't take in stuff. And the only thing that sounded good to me going in for my last 20 miles was pizza. And so, like, my crew literally, like, they had Aravaipa, who's the company who puts on Javelina 100, the founder's brother has a pizza company, and usually like they have the pizza company there with like a portable stove that's like just slinging pizzas during like these races. So my crew literally gets a cheese pizza for me, and what they do is as I'm coming in the crew stop, they give me the pizza, and I take the pizza slices and I shove it in my like running belt. And so literally for the last thing, like with pizza all my running belt, there's like cheese all over the place and everything. That's what I fueled on in the last 20 miles, was just like pizza shoved in my running belt. And yeah, it worked out. I could get it down, which is great.
You know, Joe, I think I have a business idea of cooking here that we can work on here. You know, pizza gel. What do you think?
Pizza gel. Oh, that actually would sound amazing. Like, it comes out hot. Like, it's just cheese and sauce. Like,
right.
It's got some extra carbs. And oh my gosh, that actually sounds like it would be so freaking rad, especially for like a cold race. Oh yeah. Like, yeah. I'm game for it.
Right. Right. And you know, endless possibilities with flavors. You could have, you know, pepperoni pizza gel, or, you know, obviously vegetarian versions, sausage, you know, whatever. Oh man, we could do a lot with this, I think.
We could do a lot. And although, like, I'm not a pineapple on pizza guy, I feel like in a gel form, it would be acceptable. But, like, that would be the only time it's acceptable, in
You're
my
right.
opinion.
You're right, brother. Yeah. And for all you folks listening who don't get pizza right, pineapple's unacceptable. Just
unacceptable.
Just totally wrong. Yep.
Yes.
I always said, if you put a pineapple on a pizza in New York, you'd just be run out of town. It's just pretty simple.
Exactly. It's probably a Red Sox fan or something like that.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
I call them scum socks, but yeah, Red Sox.
Yeah,
fans,
yeah, yeah.
that
is awesome.
Yeah, it's rare I've gone through one of these podcast episodes without ripping on the Red Sox fans at least once.
Got to. You got to. They deserve it.
Yeah, low lives. And they don't know what the hell's going on with pizza either.
Exactly.
Right. Well, so, hey, Joe, you grew up in New York, and you never mapped out a running career, obviously. I mean, most of us don't. Most of us get introduced to running in some way, shape, or form that, you know, unless our parents were Olympians, you know, rarely were we just raised in a running world. And you certainly were not, were you?
No, not at all. And, like, I always say that if, you know, 6-7 years ago, you told me like what I'd be doing now, like running coach, multiple 100-mile finishes, like, you know, with a decent placing on there as well. And, you know, running a top ranked running podcast, like that would have been like insane to me. Like I would have been like, there's no way, because not only did I not think I could do it, but it just wasn't in my DNA. It wasn't in my upbringing. Like I barely played any sports growing up. The only like quote unquote sport that I played was golf, and I was on the varsity golf team in high school, and that was pretty much it. And again, I use sport in air quotes for those who are not seeing the videos, because, like, I mean, it's arguably a sport, and I can say that because I play golf. But, you know, I never really had plans to run until really I was kind of forced to make the plans to not just run, but to really make a change in my life. And obviously, we can go into all the details and everything, but I had battled with addiction, was addicted to Adderall for many, many years, 10 plus years, diagnosed with ADHD when I was a kid, and, you know, had taken Adderall all throughout my upbringing, which totally fine. It helped me out a ton. But when I got to the point in college where I got retested and everything like that, and, you know, they still sort of showed signs of ADHD, but it was at a point where most adults didn't have to rely on it anymore. And basically the doctor said, like, do you want to be off this? Like, you don't have to be on this. And I said, no, I need to do this. And I remember the words leaving my mouth and in my head thinking, like, subconsciously, I was like, oh, like, you're addicted to this thing. But I never really addressed it head on, because to me, I was like, I have to take this or else I won't function in society.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of people can argue, yes, it's a neurochemical thing. Yes, it's a, you know, a disease or whatever like that. And, but I really truly think, like, especially now, you know, it, I guess it's a spoiler alert in the story, but, you know, 5 years sober on Adderall, like, I'm still functioning and still, you know, in my eyes and my standards, doing decently okay, I should say. And I really think that at that time, it was really just fueled by insecurity. Wasn't fueled by, like, you know, a neurochemical imbalance. Wasn't fueled by, like, all these other things. It was really just a thing of limiting beliefs about myself and what I could do. And that's what led me into that addiction. And not only did it lead to that, it led me to drink really heavily, get involved with other drugs, and just really trying to mask who I was as a person. Because when you have limiting beliefs on yourself, you make choices that try and push away that belief as much as possible, or you do things that try and, you know, outlast that belief by becoming something you're really not, right? So I like drinking, I like taking Adderall, I like doing all those things because, like, it really made me feel like I could be a functional person at the party or at work or in social settings or things like that. But in reality, like, I knew I was doing that because I had the self-belief that I couldn't do it. And so
where did that come from, you think? Where did the lack of self-belief and the insecurity all come from, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. This happens with pretty much every single person on the face of this planet. And if this doesn't happen to you, like, please let me know. I want to definitely go into it. But as I started to kind of, like, really unpack, like, where are these insecurities coming from? Like, what are these things coming from? Like, in the end of the day, when we are kids growing up, like, even if you have, like, a very loving family, even if you have, like, the most caring parents, which I'm very, very grateful that I did. Like, my parents were amazing. They were awesome. Like, I was very, very fortunate to have, like, a very good childhood. Like, we never really struggled. They always treated with me respect. They gave me the world, everything like that. Growing up, though, even when you have those things as a kid, when you perceive things like, you know, your parents interacting with you in a certain way or things like that. And again, it's not like, I'm not saying this to say like my parents were bad or everything. As a child, I perceived certain things like in a way that made me think about things for myself. So to get a little bit more specific into that, like, my mom was amazing. She is amazing. She's still here. And she had such high standards for me. Like, she always wanted me to be, you know, very high in school, like in terms of grades and performance and all those kind of things as well. And whenever I didn't, you know, come in with an A from class, like, you know, I was always being told, hey, like, you know, you need to get an A, like, what the heck? Or if it was like a 92 instead of 100%, it was like, why didn't you get 100% on these things? And that's awesome. And I love that. And, like, that's great. Like, I love that. Like, today, like, I love having those high standards and having to push on those things. But as a kid, the way that you perceive that and the way that I perceived that as a kid was that, oh, I'm never good enough. Like, no matter what I do, I'm never good enough and everything like that. And again, I'm not, this is my perception as a kid. Like, this is how we see it. And what happens is when we're young at those ages, our brain is so malleable that it creates these neurons and these wires and these views about not just the world, but ourselves based on our experiences as well. And that gets pretty much hardwired at us as a kid. And so that kind of developed into this belief that I've had subconsciously based on that too. And any negative belief that anyone has, that's where it can stem from. You can always stem it from your childhood perceptions of your life as well. And so that's really where it came from. And, you know, it really wasn't the moment until I, number one, acknowledge that. Number two, realize that it's not my fault, but it's my responsibility to deal with that and fix that. And then three, take the actions to change that, where I really started to make a positive change in my life. And part of that was running. It wasn't like the whole crux of it, but that was one of the vehicles that led me to step number three. And along the way, that I found that when I could increase the distances on what I could run, 5K, 10K, half marathon, eventually 100 miles, without having any running background, it really came with the other question of, like, what else can I do? Even if I didn't have the background that set me up for success in these things. And that led me to get sober. It led me to become an entrepreneur, to start a podcast that became top ranked and, you know, pretty much do everything that I never my wildest dreams thought I could do. And that's why I run today and why I also help other people try and hit their ultra goals. Because I truly believe if you are a better ultra runner, you do become a better person. I don't say it's a guarantee, and obviously we can talk about like what that means, right. But you know, in the end of the day, it can be used as a tool to help you in all other facets of life.
Yeah. And you know, great explanation. I appreciate all that there. And it's kind of reverse perfectionism in a way. You know, perfectionism wasn't from internal sources, but it came from outside. But you certainly absorbed it. And then it really drove everything that all of the behaviors that followed after that. And, you know, another point you made there about ultra runners out there is, yeah, there are some douchebags out there too. I mean, most ultra runners are good people, but, you know, they're douchebags everywhere in the world. But yeah, with your whole process there about trying to kind of find your way. I mean, it's kind of like the way I like to, one of the reasons why I really like coaching kids, because most of those cross-country kids are kind of that awkward kid too, who maybe didn't have a lot of self-confidence. And I love helping them discover that there is an athlete inside that little scrawny body of theirs. For a lot of them, they've never been out for a sport before. You know, somebody said, hey, you know what? All cross-country is putting one foot in front of the other. Or, you know, or if you go out for track, you can master a skill like the hurdles or the discus, the pole vault, whatever it is. It's a new skill. And it doesn't take that long to at least develop some competency with it. You know, whether you're going to become truly expert at it is up to you. It's within your grasp, though, if you decide to get into it. But at least you're picking up something new that you can master. And I think that's so huge for kids at that young age to discover that. I mean, as an adult, I had an attitude of every year I was going to take up a new sport that I was totally incompetent at and just start from scratch and figuring it out. But the confidence to do that probably only came from earlier experiences I'd had. So that's what I love to instill in these kids. And that's obviously what young Joe needed at the time, was somebody to show him that, like, hey, you can do this. It's just, it doesn't have to be perfect. You just dive in and just start doing it, and you'll develop that competency, right?
Yeah, 100%. And it's always, you nailed that on the head. It's one of those things that a big shift in kind of my life that I've made is, like, you know, not being afraid of doing shit wrong. And, like, I think that's one of the biggest things in life that holds a lot of people back, because I hear a lot of times people's like, oh, I want to train for an ultra marathon, or I want to start a business, or I want to do X, Y, and Z. And a lot of the times, like, I'm like, okay, like, great. Like, I'm curious, like, what steps are you taking? And a lot of things, like, well, I need to do research. I need to do, like, all these things. I need to, like, plan things out and, like, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, to really only start running, now obviously you want to do it smartly. Like, I'm not just saying go out and get the shoes out and run 10 miles if you've never run before. That's not what I'm going on here. But like, besides doing all the research and everything like that, and I do believe you got to take it slow if you've never ran before, but like, just get the shoes on and maybe run for, like, you know, half a mile out there today. Like start doing the thing, because what I've kind of found in my heyday is that, you know, and when I was really getting into the first personal development journey, like, I was consuming every single book, I was consuming every single piece of knowledge, and, like, just trying to read and all this stuff. But the problem was, I wasn't doing as much. I was just reading it. And it's like, a lot of people say, like, knowledge is power. And I think that's BS. I think applied knowledge is power. And the caveat to that, though, is that, you know, not only should you just be reading and applying, it should just be like, try those things out. And, like, the best way to learn is by doing. Like, the best way to learn is by doing. Like, right now, like, I consider myself a successful running coach, and I had all these things. But before I was a running coach, like, of course I took a certification. Of course, like, I use my own experience. But before I even launched my coaching business, I, you know, was working with three runners just, like, off the grid, just trying to figure out how to coach. And, like, that coaching experience, like, going through with those athletes, taught me, like, exponentially more than any of the certifications I did, even my own experience. Like, just being a coach and trying it out, learned so much more. So, like, I always, like, really have that piece of advice for people, is, like, the best way to learn is just doing. And, you know, I think it's you know, don't feel like you need all the answers. Don't feel like you need to, like, scour everything of research. Like, sure, like, maybe get a little bit informed, but, like, action trumps everything. And if you're really afraid about, like, fucking up or taking the wrong direction, like, there's a quote that always comes back to mind to me whenever I, like, feel that kind of hesitation of, like, should I be doing this? Am I really prepared? Or, like, is this the right move? I always come back to this quote, and it always has just helped me in my life, is, like, running 1,000 miles in the wrong direction is better than standing still. Why? Because if you run in the wrong direction, you know for a fact that 1,000 miles is not the way to go. Whereas if you're standing still, you're unsure of which direction. You every direction could be a possibility. Right. But if you go 1,000 in the wrong direction, you at least know that's not the direction I need to take. And that's new information that's going to help you forward into the goal. So that's what I always kind of tell myself. And usually those failures too, and those lessons and the fuck ups are usually the things that end up leading to your success in the future anyways. So anyways, that was kind of a long winded thing, but I say that because, you know, a lot of times people come to me, even some clients who I work with, they'll come to me and they'll say like, yeah, I really want to do a 100 miler, but you know, 3 years out is kind of my thing. Now, of course, if like you have, you're expecting kids, or maybe you're going through big life changes, or like, you know, maybe you're coming off an injury, or like you prioritizing other things in those years, that's a whole different story. But granted, those things are not there. And I ask them, hey, like, why 3 years from now? And they're saying, well, I feel like I need to learn a lot more. I feel like I need to do a lot of things. And then once you map it out and say, hey, if you do all this stuff and we have this training on here, you can actually do this 100 miler in 9 months and 10 months. And like, you know, of course you got to show out the plan and you got to make sure they're doing it safely and things like that too. But a lot of people like get surprised. They're like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I can do this thing this quickly. And a lot of it comes down to just like doing the thing. And granted, they're working with a coach that's helping them to do it safely, right? And that's like the big caveat on those things. But even just getting a coach or like getting help is an action step too, but you got to be willing to put in the work, because you can have an action, you can have a coach. Like I always say, like a lot of athletes are like, oh, I couldn't have done this without you. And I'm like, that's not true, because you're the one doing the work. I can write you the plan. I can write you the workouts. I can like give you the feedback, but you're the one applying it in the end of the day. Right. And so I think that's the big caveat. But anyways, I kind of down a rabbit hole, but I'm super passionate about this stuff because I truly believe I want everyone to assess. If you have a goal, ask yourself what's holding you back. And if it is like the need for learning and research and all these things, like as well, like you can probably take action a lot quicker to get you there a lot sooner than you think.
Yeah. I mean, you know, as we know, there are a million self-help books out there these days, a lot of really popular these days about how to, you know, recreate yourself, or, you know, whatever they call it. And books are nice. You can read them all you want, and hopefully they're making you a better person or getting to you wherever you want to go. But a coach is what holds you accountable. That's the step that you're going to get feedback, because, you know, if you went and bought a canned plan, for instance, and you know, life got in the way and you started drifting away, and eventually there are big gaps in that plan, you know, nobody's going to yell at you about it, you know, whereas, you know, the coach is going to hold you accountable and say, hey, you paid me because you wanted to achieve this goal. This is why I'm giving you these workouts, and you know, it only behooves you to do them. Whereas it's too easy to just let a blank piece of paper, whatever you have, just, okay, great. We'll do this next year kind of thing. And you know, then, you know, the next year becomes the year after that, and so on.
Yeah, 100%. And you know what's really, really interesting is like I've written like I don't do this anymore, but I used to just like write plans for people like as kind of like a lower tier of like my coaching stuff. Right. And so, and then I have like my athletes who are, you know, one-on-one, I check in with them every week. Like we have conversations, we have recap calls. Like I give feedback, I monitor their workouts, like all those kind of things. And, when I was writing plans, I used a program called Training Peaks, and like, you can kind of like see people if they're like nailing workouts and stuff. So when I would write those plans out, I would be able to see the workouts of the plans who I write, and just out of curiosity. And it's so interesting to see like the lack of consistency in a lot of those plans relative to my own athletes, just from the fact that like, you know, I'm looking at their workouts and things like that too. And I don't think that's a bad thing. Like, I think it's great to be held accountable. Like if it helps you, like use it. But you know, it's just interesting to see the stark contrast again. Like I can write the best plan for you in the world, but you know, if you're not applying it, then it's not going to work. So, no. It's something to think about. Like if you struggle with accountability, like, you know, definitely relying on a coach or a friend or someone to hold you accountable is a good way to help out for sure.
Yeah. You know, I use Training Peaks as well for my posse of coaching clients. And, I had one client who every single workout always put in the exact same amount of time as what I'd prescribed. You know, if they're supposed to run 45 minutes, it said 45 minutes that day. So, you know, as you know, they change colors depending on.
Yep.
And so this person's training plan looked green every single day, but it exactly matched. And, you know, I'm like, I'm pretty skeptical. Let's just say that, because it's like if you go out for a run, you know, if I'm going around my block, I'm not running the exact same. If it's a 45-minute loop, so to speak, it's not 45 minutes on the nose every day. So, so I'm kind of like, okay, we're just filling this in to keep the coach happy. Pretty
fair. 100%. And like, that's even just like a big piece of advice for a lot of people who are working with a coach is like, be honest as possible. Because like I always say, I mean, and this goes for, you know, any kind of relationship beyond like coaching too. It's just like the better input that you give, the better output you're going to get in return.
Without
right?
a doubt.
And so like, yep. yeah. And so it's like, I think a lot of people like get worried about like, you know, being truthful or like voicing like, hey, like, you know, I might miss my workout, or hey, like I might be feeling a little bit of a niggle in my leg, like for the fear of like what the perception is going to be in the end of the day. But it's like, especially in online coaching, like if you're not getting that feedback, it's hard to give the best output as possible. And so, yeah, that's a good story. And so I always say like, be as truthful as possible with your coaches as much as possible, because in the end of the day, like you hired that person for a reason and they're there to help you. And sure, like they might give you an answer that you're not going to like, but they're going to give you, if they're a good coach, that is, they're going to give you the solution that's going to help you towards your goal, even if it sucks or is shitty or anything like that in the moment. But if you give them the right input, they're going to give you the right output to help you steer towards your goals for sure.
Yep, without a doubt. So let's jump back to, you know, you talked about, you know, the ADHD days, so to speak. And I think I would have been in the exact same boat as you growing up. And they didn't have that terminology when I was a kid. And they didn't just intentionally put kids on meds. Just that was the solution for your generation, obviously. But sports was a savior for me. Being able to play ball, doing something active, and I think every kid today should be prescribed sports, not Adderall. You know, but in your day, not only were you taking Adderall, but what was the trigger? I mean, what happened to you to suddenly say, "Hey, Joe, drinking is a great idea"? What happened to make that start?
Yeah, I mean, really the thing, I remember the first time I ever got like quote unquote drunk exactly. So I, you know, had a good amount of friends in like high school, but I put like so much of my weight towards like popularity. Like that was to me, because like think about it again, if I had this limiting belief of like I'm not good enough or everything like that, like, and I'm always looking for approval because that's where it's kind of coming from. Like I wanted approval through the high school community and wanting to be as popular as possible. And the first time I had ever drank was, it was like me and like a few other people. And I used to get like pretty nervous, like talking to girls and things like that as well. And I remember having like my first like few drinks of alcohol, and basically like I was like talking to girls like it was no problem at all. And I was like, whoa, like this is rad. Like this stuff is like awesome. Like I used to be like so scared about doing this. And like right now, like I feel like I'm like so confident. Like what the heck? And like, obviously girls started liking me more, not because I was drunk, but like because I was going through and basically like having the confidence, which, you know, in the end of the day, people like that kind of quality. But I, in my mind, was like, oh, I can only get there if I get drunk. And so, and because I was just so hungry to get the approval of others, like I took the drinking to the max. Cause like I said, well, the more I drink, the more confident I'm going to get and the right. happier I'm going to be.
And the more popular,
right? That's how it starts. Yeah. Like that's how any addiction starts, because any addiction starts with a positive benefit. And like there's two driving forces in any human being. There's the moving towards pleasure and the running away from pain. And in that moment, like when I drank, I ran away from the pain of feeling like crappy about myself, but I was moving towards the pleasure of being popular and liked by other people. And so like when those factors are so huge, like that inherently creates an addiction. And this kind of goes into like deeper on like psychology and all this kind of stuff as well. But like, Tony Robbins was like a big mentor for mine, like not personally, obviously, but like, you know, reading books and stuff. And he expressed something called like the six human needs that drives human behavior and everything. And those six human needs are certainty, uncertainty, love and connection, growth, contribution. And then, there's one more that I'm missing off the top of my head. What's a face? I'm forgetting one of them off the top of my head. But anyways, regardless, whatever that other one is, as I might just be looking this up in my notes, I can't believe I'm spacing on this, but significance, that's the other one, significance, which is like the one that probably drove me the most. And he was saying that when you have something meet at least four of those human needs, it becomes an addiction. So like for me, when I was like drinking, it led to certainty because I knew what getting drunk felt like and how it was going to feel. So that's uncertainty, but also led to uncertainty because you never know how the night was going to go when you're drunk, right? You never know what adventures you're going to get into. Led to significance because it led me to be a lot more popular. And then it led to connection and love because girls were actually like, you know, connecting with me. It was like kind of cool, right?
Yeah.
So those four things, addicted. And that led me down that path. I mean, granted too, like ultra running now gives me those four needs, right? Certainty, because I know right. I'm going to feel uncertainty. You don't know the adventure on the trail. Significance, because a lot of people say, great job, like awesome job on the run. You get kudos on Strava. Connection and love, because I found a great community. So it's like flipping those things. But anyways, to go back to your things, it met those needs and kind of just dove into like this addiction for me too, which again, like I, for anybody, and this doesn't have to go with just addiction, but it can go with like shitty habits or like anything that you do. Likely it's because you're meeting those needs with that specific action. And I always say, like, what are some positive ways you can meet those human needs in a way, in an activity that's way more self-serving than the one that you're doing, you know, today, that might not be moving to you towards the person you want to be.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, that whole feeling kind of led you, I mean, did you go to college after that? Or I know you ended up in the finish. Okay. So
I went to Penn State too. So like that just made the partying just way
I can well worse. Imagine. I went to University of Pennsylvania, by the way. So it's funny.
Oh, you went to the more esteemed Pennsylvania school.
Well, yeah. Well, the one where we always said, yeah, that Penn State, it's just it's a football team with some partying students around it, you know?
Yeah. No, exactly.
Yeah, basically it's funny. We both migrated from New York to PA, but yeah, no, I'm sure Penn State fed your addictions and hedonistic behavior a whole lot there, right?
100%. Yeah. And I was in a fraternity. So like, I mean, the social powers in like a fraternity are just like even elevated to the max with like social status and everything. Like, it's just like, it was literally feeding the beast, like to like the point where it was just, you know, becoming way out of control.
Yeah. Yeah. So at some point, you must have hit bottom, hit that point where you just said, okay, I've got to make a change here. And I would assume that was sometime after college. You were in the corporate world. I mean, you were pretty high driving. I know you're in the financial sector. So, I mean, I remember when I came out of college and I was in the business world and, Friday, Saturday nights, maybe a lot of nights during the week, it's like, let's go out and, you know, find our, you know, feel our oats, so to speak, you know? So I'm sure that world you were in fed an awful lot of that. So at some point you must've just hit a wall there, right?
Yeah, 100%. And I went into, I worked at Wall Street. I worked at one of like the, you know, most well-known hedge funds in the world, so to say. And like, basically I went there because I wanted to make a lot of money for the same exact reasons why I took a lot of drugs. Like, I thought it would lead to all this approval. And, you know, basically it came to a point where it's like, I was on Wall Street and obviously it was feeding the behaviors a lot more, but you know, in the end of the day, like I had money, like I had all this stuff that I thought would get me, you know, fulfillment in life and feeling happy. But, you know, it led to a point where I just felt that like the most empty that I've ever been. Like, I don't know. Like, it just felt so deep. It felt so like painful. And I came to a point where it almost led to like an existential crisis. Like, what the heck? Like, money's not getting me happy. Like, all this like partying and drugs and things like that, like all this is not like getting me happy. Like, what do I really need to do with my life? And, you know, a lot of people ask for like, quote unquote, the moment. And I don't think there was like a moment that kind of triggered it for me. It can be for a lot of people, right? Like they get into a near death situation or like, that was the moment, like my life changed. Like for me though, it was a stacking of all the small moments. And eventually like think about it. Like when you stack like one pebble of sand, like a day, like you don't even see it, but right. Like do it for a long enough time and it's a whole beach. And then you're like, that's a lot of sand. And so like the same thing goes with like pain and bad decisions. Like they stack up to a point where you're just like, oh my God, like this is really, really bad. And it basically came to a point where I was, you know, living with my parents at the time. I'd, you know, moved back with them. I quit my job on Wall Street. Like, basically, I was out of a relationship that I was in for 4 years. Like, I'd alienated a lot of my friends. Like, I was just in a mess. And I remember just like looking up at like the floor of like my room in my parents' house and just thinking like, oh God, like I need to change something. Like, what it was. And that was kind of like the moment that I knew that I needed to change something, and kind of where everything really started.
Yeah. And think about it. A lot of those feelings you had that, you know, this was what's going to make me happy is really fed to you by this American machine of marketing and advertising and, you know, everything showing you like, this is how you're going to be happy because, you know, you're the life of the party and you're going to have a lot of money. And, it's interesting how you became a product like anybody's going to be susceptible to do in this country.
Yeah. 100%. And it's just like one of those things that, you know, I mean, you gotta like be very self-aware. And I think like that's the biggest thing, is like you start to realize that your life is determined by like how, what your perception is of it, right? Like what your perception of it is, and like what your belief and like how, you know, your model of the world is. And a lot of the times that's like driven by our subconscious, and we don't even know like what's going on in that subconscious unless we truly kind of sit down and analyze those kind of things, right? Yeah. And so like the moments that I really made the change, obviously like I made the decisions and stuff like that, but it's like when you realize that like you can, like there's an operating system in the back of your mind that is literally controlling everything that you do. And once you become aware of that, that's like where you can really, really just gain the skills to change it. Because if you just kind of run your life on autopilot, you are to the whims of like the external environment and things happen to you and things like that. But like, unless you go in and control those things, I mean, even if you like an example that I always like to give is like, you know, a lot of times people will, they're trying to lose weight, like they're maybe 300 pounds. And like they did, like, for example, like, you know, The Biggest Loser, right? Everyone remembers that show.
Yeah.
Like everybody would lose like an exorbitant amount of weight, but like they followed those people after the TV show and they would put it all back. And, you know, a lot of that show was really designed on just like these extreme weight loss methodologies. But the problem is, if you don't change the operating system in your brain, your beliefs about food, your beliefs about life, your beliefs about things, you're just going to go right back into the same thing before. And
quite
so
true.
Like, don't just fix the actions, fix the beliefs, and then the actions will take care of itself. Not just tomorrow, not just the next week, but for the rest of your life.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Very good points there, Joe. So, Joe, did you, where did this realization come from that you had to kind of make this change, move west, whatever you did? I mean, did it come from Tony Robbins or other things you read, or did you have a mentor? I mean, what really kind of sparked the, okay, I know I need to make a change, but what sparked the, okay, this is the path I want to take right now?
Yeah, 100%. So, I mean, to bring back to Tony Robbins, and I want to say like he, you know, changed my life and everything like that. But like, it really was, I remember just like going into Barnes and Noble and I was just like, I need to find like a book, like, I don't know, like maybe a book's going to help me, like whatever. And because I loved reading books about like finance and all those things as well. And like, I learned so much about like stocks and investing just from like reading. And so I thought like, okay, well, I need to learn how to like basically be a fucking good person. And I was like, maybe I can like actually read a book that's going to help with that. And I saw this book with Tony Robbins on it, Unlimited Power. And I had known about Tony Robbins. Like I had heard like he's a self-help guy, very prominent. And so I didn't know much about him, but I was like, you know what? Maybe I'll give this a shot. The book was like $10. I was like, fuck it, whatever. Like I'll give it a read. And the book's like 500 pages long. It's like a very, very long book. But I remember like going home and reading that. And I read it in like a matter of like 2 days, just like, couldn't believe it. And the big
there's the ADHD there, kicking in again there.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. Just tunnel focus.
Right.
And what really shifted it in my mind was like the way that the book starts out is that, you know, Tony talks about like a situation where, you know, he was, you know, beaten and abused by his mother when he was a kid. He didn't have a father figure in his house. He was poor. He was homeless. He was overweight. Like he was just like a mess with his life. And then he talks about how he was thinking about all of this, like on a helicopter, looking out, like, you know, all these people going to see him at like an event, sold out, like wealthy, with like the woman of his dreams and everything like that. And it wasn't the fact that like he had all those things. Like to me, what unlocked was like, holy shit, like this guy had this background that was way worse than the background that I had. And he was able to like not just get the things he wanted to, but like really be fulfilled in his life. And like that to me unlocked something, because the whole crux of that thing was like, it didn't matter, you know, who Tony was or what he was born with or the life and the situations he was born with at that time, he was able to become that person that it was. So what that unlocked in me was like, it didn't matter that I had ADHD. It didn't matter that I was unathletic. It didn't matter that I wasn't like naturally like, you know, gifted in any scenario. Like I could learn skills that can get me to the person that I was. It was moving from the idea from a fixed mindset to a growth mindset, right? A fixed mindset, you believe that what you're born with is how you're going to be for the rest of your life. You're either good at math or you're not. You're either good at sports or you're not. You're either good at this or you're not, right? And that's how you always think you're going to be. And that was the mode that I operated in. But really like that point in Tony's book, and you know, at the time it wasn't conceptualized as a growth mindset, like as the more I researched into that terminology, that's where I kind of got it. But inherently it was like, you can become anything you want to be if you want to go towards that. And so like this whole idea that like beliefs are malleable, skills are malleable, like you are malleable, like, you know, a lot of times I think people like limit themselves because there's that stat that says like beyond like 25 or 28, whatever the fuck the age is like, you know, your brain doesn't like, that's bullshit.
It's calcified,
like
you,
your
right?
brain. Yeah. That's bullshit. Like your brain is literally meant to adapt and create neural synapses and everything like that. And so for me, like that was the big jumping point. And then, you know, I kept reading books. I went to Tony's seminars. Like I did the whole Walk on Fire thing and everything like that. And, you know, funny enough, like, and I'm again, like, I don't have any like financial stake with Tony Robbins or anything. And I don't think you need to do those things. But like the day after Tony Robbins' seminar that I went to was the first day that I went sober, and I haven't gone back for 5 years since. And so the reason why I say that is because like, if you really need help, like find a mentor. And it doesn't have to be a mentor that like you personally work with. I call it like find indirect mentors, right? Yeah. Read books by someone, read or listen to podcasts, listen to like any of those things. Like, doesn't have to be a one-on-one mentor. It's like find someone who did the thing that you want to do, whether it is run 100 miles, whether it is get sober, whether it is, you know, become a competitive athlete with no competitive background. There's probably someone out there who's doing the thing you want to do, and learn what they had did to get that result, and then model it in your life as well. Now, granted, to like genetics and all those things might have like a little bit of a things, but I truly believe that like most of that's a fucking limiting belief for a lot of times. And honestly, that has gotten me in trouble saying that before, but like, it doesn't like, yes, 100% circumstances can be a limiter in those things. But I truly believe that like, if you believe, even if it's not true, if you truly believe that like you have the power to get through any situation, no matter what the circumstances is, like you will find a way. Like you will find a way. Like one of the things all the time is I always think about is like the belief you tell yourself is the reality that you're going to be looking for. So like an exercise that I think is always so powerful, and I'll do this with you, Bill, is like, okay, Bill, what I want you to do for about 5 seconds is look around your room and look for everything that is the color green. All right. Look for green. Just look around for green. Okay. Look for green. All right. Awesome. Now, Bill, I want you to close your eyes.
Okay.
And I want you to tell me everything in the room that was red. Right. So like you can't, because you were looking for the other color. Now I want you to look around and see if you can find something that's red. Find something that's red. Like, tell me when you found something that's red, right?
Well, I remember my soundboard had both red and green on it, but even so, yeah, I know what
you're
saying.
There you go. Yeah, 100%. Yeah. But a lot of the times, right, it's like we find the thing that we're looking for, and we find the thing that we are seeking. So if our brain's telling us we're not good enough, if our brain's telling us we're not athletic, if our brain's telling us we're not good at X, Y, and Z, if our brain's even telling us we have ADHD, like, because I hate using that as a crutch. Like I hate, like you'll rarely hear me say like, oh, like I suck at this thing because I have ADHD. It's like, no, I suck at this thing because like I suck at this thing. And it's like, you know, it's not, I don't use that as a crutch, because like, if you tell a belief about yourself, your brain is going to try and make that true and like live it out to every single day. And so that was kind of the big thing that I tried to operate myself. And you can get those new beliefs by adopting the beliefs of other people who have gotten what they've gotten, not just the skills and the strategies and everything like that. I always like to find out like, what are the beliefs of those people? Like when I have like athletes on the podcast, of course I want to find like their training tips. I want to find like what they're doing nutrition wise. I want to find what their training structure is. But what really gets me stoked is like, what's their belief system? How do they view challenges? How do they view their lives? How do they view those things? It's like, what are the beliefs? Like, sure, I can have the actions, but if you don't have the beliefs, like it's really, really hard to make sustainable change.
No, I totally agree with you. And, you know, David Clark had, He kind of opened my eyes to the fact that growth or change is a lifelong process. I mean, I've been going along for so long, working jobs, working my own businesses, that I didn't realize that, hey, you can still be growing. And I think since I got to know David, who founded this podcast here, I've probably grown more in those years, you know, 5, 6, 7 years. I knew him for probably 10 years, whatever. Probably grew more in that time than any other point in my life since probably going back to college days, when obviously you do a lot of growth back then. What impresses me about what you've done here with your change, if you would, you started out in some very selfish pursuits, basically. You were looking at, I just want to go ahead and make as much money as I can. I'm just going to make myself happy. And you've really flipped the switch to wanting to help others, to have their own journeys like that, to help them with their running, which, as you know, as we all know, affects all other aspects of your life. And To me, you know, whether it was Tony Robbins or just kind of the fog lifting out of your brain from not using the drugs and alcohol and everything to finally realizing that the path to happiness, if you would, is about helping others. And not that you are doing it because you're trying to make yourself happy, but you genuinely have a desire to help others. And, you know, whether it's your coaching business or the your podcast, which I love the podcast. I haven't even talked about it. I love the way you bring in so many different kinds of people into the ultra running world, or from the ultra running world, whether they are ordinary people or some of the names in the world. I mean, it's really cool. And I think you're showing everybody that it's an everyman's kind of sport. And again, you're showing that to people. And I think it's really great how you flip the switch from one extreme, if you would, to the other.
Yeah, 100%. And thank you so much for that. I appreciate all the kind words on there. And you nailed it. Like, I think the big kind of crux and like a big shift. And like, this was a quote that like totally changed my life. It was like, the secret to living is giving, right? It's like, when you give, you get back so much more. And like, for me, like, I was just in the pursuit of me, how much money I can make, how can I be happy, like, blah, 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 which I still think is a focus. Like, you should still try and think about, like, obviously, like, how you feel and everything like that. But when it comes to like your contribution to the world, it's like, how can you like really give in a way? Because like, the amount that you give, like, you're going to receive back in a disproportionate amount of what you've given. Now, I don't say that to say like, give with the expectation of getting, like, you really truly
no, you
need
can't.
To care
Absolutely
about like
can't.
What you're giving. Yeah, 100%. Right. But when you shift your mindset to giving, and instead of, you know, getting, that's a huge thing too. Cause even so, like, after I kind of made the change and got sober and things like that, I tried to start my own business and like tried to do all those things. And I was so focused on like money. And like, it failed. Like, it failed miserably. It was terrible and blah, blah, blah. And then like, basically, like, when I started Everyday Ultra, like, when I started Everyday Ultra, there was never any goals to monetize it. There was never any goals for the coaching business. There was never any goals for anything that I did. Like, literally, I did that just so I can, you know, have education out to all the ultra runners. That was the goal.
Right.
Like, that was simply the goal. And that had become into a profitable business, like, which was awesome. And so, and again, like, the point was, and still even the point of the podcast, even though it is like my full-time job and I do coaching and things like that, of course, like, you know, as a business owner, I do have to think about those things, but still my decisions are informed by, how is this going to help other people, as opposed to, how am I going to make a buck off of this, or how am I going to expand the bottom or top line? And it's like, when you shift your moment to like, how can I give, as opposed to what do I get in most things in your life, like, that's going to help out for sure. Now, I'm not saying be a martyr and just like blow up your life for the sake of, you know, other people as well.
Right.
You still got to, like, you know, make decisions for you and everything like that. But, you know, a lot of the times giving is a big, big thing when it comes to just fulfillment in life. As I mentioned with the six human needs before, what was one of those big human needs? Contribution.
Right.
And as I mentioned, those six human needs, right, the two are the ones that lead to true fulfillment, or the last two that I mentioned, growth and contribution. Like, when you're growing, like, that is one of the biggest things as well. Like, think about the times in your life when you felt the most fulfilled in your life. You were probably making progress in some way, shape, or form, right? You got better. Like, that is the key. And so anytime you're feeling stuck, always ask, how can I grow in this situation? And if for some reason growth is hard, or it's attainable, or it's not a quick fix, right? Because growth is never really a quick fix. You can't grow from one day to another. Of course you can, maybe a little bit, but in the end of the day, growth is hard and it takes some time. And if you can't grow, find out a way you can contribute. That's the second thing. How can you give? You can give any day of the week. You can give, and it doesn't mean monetarily. It doesn't mean by doing something. It just means texting a friend and just saying, hey, I'm thinking of you, and I just want to let you know that I'm rooting for you today. Or it can just be, you know, going through and, you know, open the door for someone, whatever it is. Like, giving is a great way. So like, that's how I kind of just shape my life, is like, how can I grow and contribute? And that was another big thing with the six human needs, is like, there's always one of those needs that drives the rest of it. And one of the decisions that I had to make in my life, because before, I'm sure you can probably guess which is the one that drove my life, which was significance, which, funny enough, is the one that I didn't even remember, which is funny, but like, that's great,
yeah, right,
because I guess it's not my sphere of consciousness. But now it's like, my orientation's around like growth and contribution, and how can I like orient my decisions around that? And when you make that the forefront of your life, you can create a fulfilling life in ultra running, business, family, relationships, anything of the sorts.
No, and it creates ripples, because when you help other people, it influences something beyond that. I mean, I often look at this situation where I'm one of those people who just talks to people in the line at the supermarket, you know, while we're waiting. And, you know, that person you talk to may have had a really bad day. You know, I don't care if the person it really is looking, you know, pissed off or whatever. I'll talk to them. And, you know, all of a sudden that person may walk out of that supermarket thinking, hey, you know, somebody noticed me, or somebody, you know, I had, you know, a good conversation with somebody that I wasn't expecting. And they go home and instead of yelling at their kids, they're like maybe a little nicer about it or something. And, you know, so again, it creates ripples out there. And, you know, I was just traveling in Asia this October and November, and everybody there is so nice and they're so polite. And, you know, you come back to this country, sometimes you go, God, this place sucks. Everybody's so pissed off and mean. And you know, I'm just like, God, why can't they be like those nice people in Japan and Korea and Taiwan, and et cetera? It's like, it's just, you'd like to create those ripples. I wish everybody could just go over to those countries and just see how nice everybody is and maybe come back with a little different perspective on treating others, you know?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, even just like moving from New York to here was New York to Wisconsin, that was a bigger
New Yorkers are the nicest people in the world. Don't give me that crap.
They're the most honest people in the world, I would say.
That's
but like,
true.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, you go to New York, it's very callous. It's very like, you know, I truly believe like the stereotype does match for sure. But then I went to like Wisconsin and like similar to you, people are like chatting me up in the grocery store. People are like, you know, acknowledging me. And at first I was like, this is like a little weird and interesting, but like after a while I was like, it actually feels kind of good, like this is kind of cool. And so I think it does make the difference in the world. And you know, again, I don't like to blame the circumstances that I was in, but I think even just moving to like a lot of those places where people are more friendly, it's great. And like even so, like I was very, when I first started getting into running out here in the running community, I was very intimidated by like running with people who were better than me and faster than me and things like that, right? Because it's like, I don't know how they're gonna like look at me and blah blah blah. And that's never happened to me once. Like I've never felt belittled. Like I've always felt welcome, like everything like that. Even when I have like guests on the podcast from like these elite ultra runners who I'm like looking up to, like they're like, I have never had a guest on the podcast where I was like that person was not a bad person, like even just a decent person. Like every person I've had on the podcast has been a good person and like really caring. And like, I think like that's just like the cool thing is like once you realize like people are inherently good. Like I truly believe that. I believe that down to the core. I believe that people are inherently good. But sometimes when you let those beliefs again mask the person that you are truly deep down inside, like that's where shit can go a little crazy. I mean, like if you think about the extreme things, like think about like, you know, some of the dictators and some of like the really, really bad leaders in the world, like what's driving their decisions are these beliefs about the world, right?
Yeah.
And sometimes those beliefs can be really, really bad, right? And so I just one thing to think about is like when you let those negative beliefs take hold of the decisions that you do, like it can either be used for great things if you believe great things, or if you believe absolutely shitty things, it can lead to monstrosities and wars and terror and all this really other extreme stuff well.
Yeah. But I will say though, anybody I know from Colorado who has gone to New York fearful of what it's going to be like dealing with New Yorkers, without fail, they come back and go, oh my God, New Yorkers are so nice. I mean, like, you know, I tell them, I said, yeah, if like you're on Fifth Avenue and you ask like, which bus do I need to take to get uptown? They're not going to just point to you. They're going to actually go to that corner, the bus stop with you, stand there and make sure you get on the right bus. So, you know, that's New Yorkers for you.
New Yorkers are good. Like, they're good people. They're just very busy.
Yeah, that's true. Oh, gosh, I had another thing I was going to say there based on what you were just saying there, and I just lost track of that. But, human nature. Oh, I know what I was going to say. So, you know, I once had this conception of Dean Karnazes as being kind of a – when he was doing his 50 marathons in 50 states and 50 days. And I thought, oh my God, this guy is so self-centered, so conceited. It wasn't until when he got to the end of it and I found out that he was doing this for charity that, and what he was doing it for, I thought, okay, the guy's not as bad as I thought. And then I had him on the We Are Superman podcast and damn, what a nice guy he was. And, you know, I just enjoyed the heck out of talking to him. And maybe it's a little bit, you know, with our sport. I mean, it's kind of like hockey players. Hockey players are way more down to earth than any other of the pro athletes you meet out there. In fact, at one point, I remember I got to meet a bunch of the Philadelphia Flyers. I used to go back to Brian's run in Philadelphia every year, and they used to treat me as a little mini celebrity because they'd never really heard of anybody running ultra marathons. It was pretty funny. So I got to meet a bunch of these Philadelphia Flyers who, being a Rangers fan, I hated those fuckers. I mean, that was I'm not
fond of the Flyers either.
No. And this was the era of the Broad Street Bullies. You may be a little too young to remember that, but you know, back then in Philadelphia, it was always like, well, the Flyers lost the game tonight, but they won the two fights, and here are the highlights of the fights. You know,
right.
Yeah, and I got to meet these Flyers, and it's like, God damn it, these guys are nice guys. You know, it's like, you know, they're hockey players, they're more down to earth, but it's like, you know, I wanted to hate them, and I couldn't.
Yeah, well, it's so funny you mentioned that too, because like one of the more memorable experiences that I've had in my life was this is aside from running, but you know, when I was working at my full-time job before I, you know, left and became a coach full-time, I worked for a software company, and without getting into the minutia, like we went down to Nashville for like a business trip, and we went to like NHL playoffs. The Predators were in elimination game, and like we got to see that they got eliminated. They were like the eighth seed, so like they never really had a chance. But then like later that night, like we went out to a bar, and like again, I wasn't drinking. I was just kind of going out with friends and just like, you know, whatever. Like I still like hanging out with friends and stuff like that. And the Nashville Predators were there, and they like saw us there, and like basically invited us to come like hang out with them. And like it was so wild, like they were asking about like my life, and they're like, oh, like what do you do, like do you have like kids, like blah blah blah, like, and I was just like, what the heck, like how, like this is wild. So like, yeah, it's, I think, and I was actually thinking about this morning, it's like a lot of times, now I'm not saying this is everybody, but like more times like we put a lot of people like on a that pedestal in our mind, and like in terms of like, oh, like they're this like out of larger than life kind of human being or like thing, like that's just like so much more than I am. But what I've realized, like even just having the podcast and like talking with people who like I very much look up to, like some of my biggest role models in my entire life, like when I talk with them, you realize that like, because like everybody has like, they get nervous sometimes, like when, like, I used to get nervous like talking onto you know, my first podcast episode, like my first big podcast interview that I ever got like super, super nervous for, like for the Everyday Ultra podcast, was with Mike McKnight. And Mike McKnight, you know, he's arguably the best 200-mile runner, male in our generation, like just awesome, like down, like just, you know, amazing athlete in every regards. And I was like very, very nervous having him on the podcast. And what's super cool is like now, like we're friends, like, you know, I've seen him at races before, like we've gotten like, you know, dinner together at times, like we text like back and forth, like it's like so cool. And it's like, oh, like, you know, he's a good person. He is a human being. Not to say like he wasn't before, but like we have this perception in our mind that like maybe the people that we look up to like aren't like people in the end of the days, but they really are, and they're good people. And so it's like, that's why like anytime like I'm ever at like an event or like things like that, like I'm going to Black Canyon tomorrow, and just like being there, and like I want people to come up to me and say hello. And like, you know, even like people like Sally McRae, who's like, you know, good friend of mine, like she's awesome, like every time I see her at events, like people are coming up to her, and she will be there for like 2 hours just like talking with people, down to earth, present in the conversation. And I'm like, man, that is just so freaking awesome. And so I think just knowing that like people are people in the end of the day, and like people are good, and people are just like us, like it's just, it's a down to earth kind of feeling. So I don't know, huge tangent on there, but like I wanted to bring that up because I was like thinking about it, like coming off my run today. So it was a very relevant thing to bring up.
Yeah, no, definitely. And it is true. I mean, I've been a sports writer, and you know, you talk to some of the stars, and it's like, well, you know, they still have to go to the grocery store. They still have to go buy clothes. And, you know, it is funny. Yeah. They do have ordinary lives to certain extents. And obviously some of these guys live in a whole different world than we do. And, you know, it's like, I know the owner of the Colorado Rockies, Dick Montfort. And, it is funny when you talk to him, and it's just like, yeah, I realize, yeah, he just takes 92 of his friends on a golf outing to Palm Springs every year. It's like, okay, I like to play golf, but I may get a foursome together, and we all pay our own way. A little different, but yeah, he's just out there playing golf and probably having the same issues with his swing that I do, you know?
Right, 100%, 100%.
Yeah. So, hey, Joe, I'm going to ask you to give some people some advice here in a way. So basically, it's going to be a long question of sorts, but you know, I've seen, when I've researched things for some of my coaching clients, I've had people, I even had a client one time ask me, I asked him what his goal was with the training he wanted me to provide him. He said, I want to be a model. And I'm like, oh, okay. I don't know anything about that. So I went out there and I researched, well, what are models trying to get at here? And so, I go on the internet, and, you know, I go on social media, I see all these people who basically hang out a shingle by like, really common with like 20-year-old bodybuilders, if you would. You know, they all like to show, here's my scrawny body when I was 16 years old, and like a year or two later, I am this buff, you know, 18 or 19-year-old kind of thing. And I think that's really interesting. They're out there selling workout programs, having basically been an experiment of one. You know, they built themselves up, and now they think they're an expert at it. And I'm sure a lot of, you know, young people were looking at this like, yeah, I want to look like that dude. And so you started from nowhere yourself. Mm-hmm. And, you know, within a short time, you got to be not only a competent runner, but a very competent coach as well. But I think what you had going for you, from what I can tell, you know, what I've listened to on your Everyday Ultra podcast, et cetera, is that you've got that ADHD working for you in a way. You took a very deep dive into everything. And you didn't just say, well, you know, Joe Corcione has run some marathons, so now he knows how to coach marathoners. Or you really dove in. So, I mean, what advice would you want to give to somebody who says, yeah, I want to be this someday, but I am over here? So, you know, how do I get from point A to point Z, so to speak, the Joe Corcione way?
Yeah, I love this question so much. I think it's great because I think this is the crux to getting anything you want in life and becoming anything you want to be. And so it really comes down to a process. I think like number one is like you have to, before first and foremost everything, a lot of this conversation has been about belief, and that's got to be the first thing. The first thing is you need to believe with every core of your being that you can become whoever you want to become. Not the specific thing we're trying to get yet. Like you truly need to be like, understand the human element is to adapt, and we are meant to adapt as humans. Like humans are meant to adapt. It's how we've been able to learn things. It's how we're able to do those things. And ultimately, you got to realize if you're human, you can change and you can become whoever you want to become. And you got to believe that deep down into your core. Now, how do you go through that? How do you go through that belief changing process? There's a lot of different many ways and stuff, but I truly believe that it comes from stacking undeniable proof of who you say you are, like in actual reality, right? Because you can sit there and you can have the mantras, you can look in the mirror and say like, I can do it, I can do it, I can do it. But if you don't truly believe it, your brain's going to come in and be like, bullshit. Like you don't actually believe it and it's not going to make sense. So I always say like, take down a piece of paper and write down different things that you didn't think you can do that you did, right? And there's got to be at least a few things in your life and you can show yourself through real evidence that you can get to that thing, right? So like for me, like when I was going through this whole process of like rewiring my beliefs, like even though at the time, like I didn't have the experience that I could, and this was for me, like going into running, right? Going into running. And I even started running before I got sober, by the way. So like this was even before the things, but I knew I wanted to be a runner. So like with running, like what I did was I actually wrote down the things that I made progress on. I said like, okay, I actually went to school to Penn State for journalism. That's what I actually went to school for.
Yeah.
And then I actually switched and I went to finance. And like for me, like I always sucked at math. Math was always like my worst kind of thing. But I was like, oh my gosh, like I got a job at like one of the top ranked hedge funds. And I did that through learning and adapting and like trying my skills and things like that. It's like, oh my gosh, I did that. I did become someone. Oh my gosh. And I didn't fully realize that. So write down the things that you weren't good at before. And then you learn the skills to get good at. And that starts to like show you the true evidence that you can become whoever you want to become. So without the belief, like I can give you all the steps. Like if you don't have the belief, your brain's going to come in the first time you fuck up and it's going to be like, see, I told you so. You're not cut out for this. And then you don't go through it. A lot of times why people don't stick with it is not because they're inconsistent, not because that they fail, not because of anything like that. It's because they have the belief that they can't change. And then when difficulty arises, they said, see, you can't do it. So belief comes first. The second thing is you want to clearly and specifically define the endpoint. Now, those two words are very important, clear and specific. What do you want? Like, so let's just say you want to run 100 miles, right? You want to run 100 miles. Like, that's your thing. And you can say like, yeah, I want to run 100 miles. Great. Like, that's not enough. Like, when do you want to run 100 miles by? I want to run 100 miles by the time I'm 30 years old. Great. That's awesome. For 100 miles, like, what do you want to do? Do you just want to finish? Do you want to, like, place top in your age group? Do you want to be on the podium? Like, what do you want to do? Like, I just want to finish 100 miles. Great. Awesome. Now, like, where do you want to do this? Do you want to do this home? Like, you want to make it as specific as possible and define that end goal of what you want as specifically, because the more specific you get, the more targeted actions you can take. A lot of times people have a very broad view of the goal they want to do. I want to make a lot of money. I want to start a business. I want to become an ultra runner. But unless you have the specific endpoint, it's going to be really, really hard to make those focused actions towards what you want to be. So for me, my biggest goal eventually, like, and I'm still on this path and kind of going towards it, was I want to be a golden ticket winner at one of the most competitive 100 mile races in the United States, which is Javelina 100. Like, great. Yeah. Awesome. That's very specific. I know exactly what I need to do. Great. Now you have that end goal. Then what you want to do is a combination of two of these things. And I say combination because, like, again, you don't want to do too heavy in one or the other. The combination is, number one, think about the one thing that you can do, not today, not tomorrow, but right after you write this down, after you go through this process, what you can do to move closer towards that goal. And the reason why I say that action, that small action step. So again, sticking with the ultra runner example, if you want to become an ultra runner, maybe buy a pair of shoes. If you want to become an ultra runner, plan the run tomorrow. You know, hire a coach, like whatever those things are, make one action to get there as well. And then the second thing concurrently is try and find some education while you're taking action. This is not like before, like big distinction. Don't wait to take action just by doing a bunch of research, because you can do all the fucking research, but if you're not taking action, it's not going to be doing. So in conjunction with the action you were taking to move step towards a goal. And by the way, reading a book is not an action. Like that's not an action. I mean, like right. Actually doing something, find education in conjunction. So that can mean listening to a podcast, doing research online. That can mean hiring a coach, anything like that. And then, like, you have that plan on there. And then the second thing is, and then once you have that action in place and just define, like, what you're going to be doing, you want to come up with a timeline and an action plan to do it. So for running, it's very easy. Training plan, coach, something that's going to give you that day-by-day kind of thing to get you where you want to be, right? Like, I truly believe if you just wing your training, you're probably setting yourself up for success. Some people can do it. Most people can't. And so, but the reason why training plans and even coaches are so great is because it gives you that day-by-day thing of what you need to do. So you don't wake up in the morning and be like, what the fuck do I do? You look on the training plan, you say, oh, okay, today I have an hour easy run of strides. Boom, you know exactly what to do. You can just go ahead and do it. So like having that action plan to go from A to B is where you need to go. Now, by the way, with A to B, if you're unsure, again, like just do it and figure it out, or right. Try and learn. Don't do one or the other at the same time, because if you just take a bunch of action, you're probably going to get there a lot slower. But if you just learn all the time, you're never going to make action at all. So you got to find a blend of the two. And generally, like how I kind of like model that on the pursuit, this is getting into the more advanced class, but like if you're taking a ton of action, you feel like you're not making progress, that means you might want to skew a little bit more towards learning. But if you're learning so much and you feel like you aren't making progress as well, you probably got to take more action. So you got to find the healthy balance between the two along the way. And anyways, then in the end of the day, and then the last step is while you're doing it, make note of the lessons in the failures and the successes along the way. What has been working well? Where it's your progress? Tracking your progress every single day. Like if you're not tracking your progress, you're doing things at random and you don't know where things are. You need to be able to track the progress. Are you able to increase your endurance? Is your pace dropping? Is your mental resiliency getting there, right? Making notes of that. Did you DNF like a tune-up race? Did you nail a tune-up race? What are the lessons learned from that? And then apply those lessons in your journey to eventually get to the goal. And here's the reality. It might take 6 months. It might take 1 year. It might take 2 years. It might take 3 years. But this is the last step and the most important one that I can give for sure. Is enjoy the process.
Yes.
It's not about the outcome. It's about the process. It's about the process. It's about the journey. It's not about the destination. It's about the ride going over there. Like that's what you need to do. And you need to find enjoyment in the process, because if you don't, then that outcome is one day of the year. If you're doing a 200 mile race, it might be 3-4 days of the year, but like your training is day after day after day after day, and you need to really enjoy it. So long-winded answer, but right there, if you follow that, you can get literally whatever you want in your life. And I will stand by that statement. You can get whatever you want in your life if you want to go ahead and do that, if you go with that formula, for sure.
Yeah, no, I love all that, man. That's great. And thank you for taking the time to explain all that, you can take a breath now. I know you get fired up talking about that, which is great, because
I do.
It's passionate. It's kind of what is part of the essence of who Joe's all about. I'm going to build on that just a little bit. And I think there's something to that, taking that leap and maybe making some mistakes along the way. And, you know, obviously we all know you learn from making mistakes and things like that. But like my first marathon was when I was a freshman in college. I ran the Penn Relays Marathon, and I'd been running for, I don't think I've even been running for a year at this point. And back then, it's not like I could go online and look up training programs for the marathon. There was nothing out there in those days. This is the 1970s. And I mean, we got Runner's World and Running Times magazines once a month, and there may or may not have been. I don't even know where I got my ideas about. Well, I'll tell you where my ideas about training from a marathon came from. Nowhere. I mean, it was, I think my first marathon, I trained for 5 weeks, and one of those weeks was spring break in Fort Lauderdale. So, yeah, it wasn't ideal. And, you know, it was, I dove into this idea of running this marathon. I finished 20 miles of it. I was running in shoes that today we'd call cross trainers. And I hurt like a mother. But you know what? I came back and I finished that sucker the next year.
Nice.
Because I did learn something from that. And again, it wasn't like I could go back. But, you know, it's one of those things where sometimes you can't be afraid. You go in right. there, you dive in, you make some mistakes. And back then, again, without having a lot of mentors, I got a cat crawling up my back here right now. This is Judge over here.
Oh, good old Judge.
Yeah, Judge, you want to come on up here and see what's going on? Come here. Yeah, she's, this is, come here. This is Judge the kitten here.
That is awesome. Judge is awesome.
Yeah. No, she's a character. If usually when I pick her up, she wants to jump right on my shoulders here, which is really uncomfortable, but it's pretty funny there. So talk a little bit, Joe, about how you applied those lessons, if you would, to go from, again, novice to expert in these fields.
Yeah. So, I mean, so many things that we can kind of go into on, but I guess we can maybe dive into like the ultra running kind of area, like for it too. So like for me, like when I knew I wanted to become like a competitive ultra runner in the end of the day, like the big kind of scary goal for me was like, of course, like I wanted to, you know, run ultras and everything like that. But right now in my life, it's like, how do I'll kind of do something real life example, because I haven't attained it yet, but I'm on the process to it. And that one is, you know, winning a golden ticket at Hoveling 100. Like that's the one that I want to do. I want to do these things. So for me, like, the belief was like, I had to truly believe that I can do those things. I always check those things. I always, even if I, like, I know that I believe that to my core, but I still like remind myself of those things every single day. Like I think about the things on my run of like, wow, look at how far I've come and everything like that. Like helping to reinforce that every single day. So that's like step number one. Step number two was really just going through and defining clearly what that is. Like I want to get a golden ticket, a Hoveling 100, placing top two male. Like that's what I want to do and get that golden ticket. Like I want to do this ASAP. So like that, I only got one shot a year though to do it. So I was like, okay, that's what I want to do. So that's like the next thing on there is like getting super clear on that too. The third thing is, you know, taking an action step like today. So at the time with the action step, what I did was I basically, was like, okay, like I'm going to hire a coach who has done the thing that I want to do that's going to help me get there. So I hired at the time, Zach Bitter, who had won, he's yep. gotten the course record at Hoveling 100, incredible runner, former world record holder at most or fastest 100 mile time.
Right.
And I was like, okay, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to work with him. And then with him, that's where I kind of did the blend of both the learning. So I was learning from him and also doing, but then we mapped out a plan of what it would look like to get there. And let me tell you, I had runs that were great. I had workouts that weren't so great, like everything like that. And I've just been modifying along the way. And then ultimately, like I had the first time at Hoveling 100, placed 10th place male, which was, I was actually pretty stoked about, which like, I think that's like a big encouragement for a lot of people is like, even if you're going for the goal and you go for the attempt and you don't get it, if you're farther than where you were last time, that's still a win. And so that was like a big win for me. Like, I was like, great, awesome. I learned a lot. And then basically like I did what I said was, you know, you relearn and you retool those things along the way, but I've enjoyed the process. Like I've enjoyed the training so much more than, you know, the actual race itself. And I think that's just been super, super fun. So that's kind of how I'm going through it. Now I haven't hit the end goal yet. Like I'm still kind of retooling those things.
Right.
But that's how I'm kind of applying that process in my life today.
Yeah. No, we never hit the end goal, hopefully.
Yeah. It's never a finish line.
Yeah.
Never a finish line with life.
Hey, do me a favor. For some people don't know, what is the golden ticket all about?
Yeah. Golden ticket. So golden ticket is basically a few ways to get into Western States 100. So Western States 100 was the first 100 miler, I know in the US, I believe the world, I don't want to misspeak on that, but it was the first, it's the oldest 100 miler in the US. And it's a prestigious race. It's super, super awesome. Like I like really got intrigued in that race, like first reading like, you know, Ultra Marathon Man by Dean Karnazes. And I was like, oh, like this just seems so cool. And there's just so much history and like so many things on there that like, you know, I want to do that race. But I'll kind of explain why the golden ticket means more to me than just Western States. To get into Western States, you either have to apply through a lottery. You either have to place in the top 10 in your gender in the prior year, or you get in through a golden ticket or a sponsored entry. So like those are the only ways that you can get into golden ticket or get into Western States. The lottery is incredibly hard to get into.
Oh, like, yeah.
basically each year you qualify for races, you can get what are called tickets, and then every year you don't get in, you exponential your tickets, like based on the year prior, if you didn't get in the year, as long as you ran a qualifying race. Now, here's the thing. I only have 2 tickets in the lottery. After this year, I'll have 4 tickets, but like with 1 ticket, I believe the percentage chance, I don't know exactly, but it's somewhere around a 0.36% chance that you're going to get into Western States. So I was like, okay, like that's probably not going to happen. Golden ticket is if you place, there's I believe 6 events in the year where if you place top 2 in your gender, then you get an automatic bypassed entry into Western States. And these races are incredibly competitive. They're some of the best athletes. We actually have the next golden ticket race this weekend here in Arizona, Saturday, Black Canyon. Yeah. And there is probably, if I were to guess, 30 people that can go out and win that golden ticket. And like these are some of like the best ultra runners in the world, like out there competing for this golden ticket. And so these are like very, very competitive races. And so there's usually 6 of them a year. So you don't get too many chances around to do them. And they range anywhere from 100K to 100 miles. So that's kind of the golden ticket scenario on there as well. Now, for me, like with a golden ticket, it's not necessarily like, sure, yeah, I want to run Western States. That race is fucking awesome. Like the environment's amazing. The history is so cool. Like, God, I love the trails out there. I've had the privilege of running out there before, not for the race, but just being there. But really the big thing for me is like, I want to write the story of going from unathletic to like getting a golden ticket at a competitive field. And again, I don't give a shit if I get the golden ticket and I don't race Western States. Like that's not the thing. It's like just getting the golden ticket would be the win, because like for me, I want to show people it doesn't matter where you are at, you can become whoever you want to become. So my hope is that like if I can show people that someone who has no running background can show up at one of the most competitive start lines in the world and compete and get a golden ticket, I want people to say, oh, I can lose 10 pounds. Oh, I can ditch the alcohol. Oh, I can lace up my shoes and train for my first 5K, even though I haven't ran before. Oh, I can be a parent. Like I want to show people that I can do it by taking it to a huge extreme in ultra running, to let people just make changes in their life for sure. So like, that's my whole like mission and goal and everything like that. And I feel like, you know, even though I haven't get it, and even if I never get there, like it's even just like the, where I've kind of come, like still placing 10th place male, like at that race was just like, in my eyes, like, and some may argue, but I think it's impressive to me, which I think is very important too. But like, I also, at least if I'm just shooting for it, like if there's anything that can go for it, like even if I don't get it, I think even just me shooting for it, I think is inspiring, because, yeah, it's a big risk. And people ask all the time, are you scared? Like, yeah, fuck yeah, I'm scared. Like, are you like, you know, you're putting these big goals out there. I'm very vocal about it. I don't fucking hide it. Like I will go ahead and say it. And, but I do that because I want people to have the confidence to swing for the fences on their own goals for sure.
Well, and that's swinging for the fences for sure. I mean, someday it'll be kind of funny for you to go back to your high school reunion, I bet. And people are going to sit there and go, wait a second, you did what? You know, compared to the person they knew when you were in high school. I remember that from the one and only high school reunion I ever went to. It's like, it seemed like all the screw up kids were now like Wall Street brokers and, you know, successful people. And the guy who was voted most likely to succeed was, he was doing all right, but, you know, nothing great. But, I think it'll be funny at your high school reunion when people hear like, you did what?
Yeah, 100%. It's always interesting. It's like I don't stay in touch with a lot of people from high school, but like I've had some people who do reach out from high school and be like, wow, like this is like so super cool. And like that's not what I do it for in the end of the day. And like honestly, like I do see like some people from high school. Like I saw one person from high school. They were like on Jeopardy the other day, and it's just, oh, really? It's so cool. Yeah, it's just like really cool to just see like other people's progress and things like that. But yeah, it's yeah, it's, and a lot of times, like, you can see that with other people, like Mike McKnight, I bring him up again, like, he had, like, a pretty crazy past as well. Even, like, Jim Walmsley, like, he had, like, problems with, like, alcoholism, like, the military and things like that, and, like, you know, he's Jim Walmsley today, and so I just love those stories, and I think that's why, like, you get a lot of appeal with, like, David Goggins. Like, I think the reason why David Goggins got so popular wasn't because he's doing crazy shit, it was because he came from someone who was 300 pounds overweight, beaten as a kid, like, and became David Goggins. That's, like, if David Goggins was born David Goggins, then he wouldn't be as popular as he is today. Like, I truly believe that. And I think because he's gotten so popular, because he showed people that you can transform.
Yeah, that's one of the things I used to always joke with David Clark about, is that, you know, he came from the 300-pound, drug-addicted, fast-food junkie, alcoholic background to become this incredible endurance powerhouse. And I kind of fucked up. I never was an alcoholic. I was never obese. I mean, I've had all these insane number of surgeries I've had to come back from every time. I'm going through yet another injury cycle here right now, and nobody gives a shit about that story. You know, I fucked up. I should have.
Hey,
no, I'm only kidding.
It's still a good comeback, man. It's still a good comeback. Like, seriously, like, I think it's awesome when someone comes back from like injury and things like that. I mean, like, even like, you know, I mean, say what you want about him, but like, what I thought was cool was like seeing like Tiger Woods like come back and win the Masters, like, even through, now granted, like, I mean, personal decisions that I don't 100% agree on, but like, you know, he had gone through like injuries and everything like that, and like to come back from the comeback story, like, that's like a cool thing to see. Like, I think injuries, all that stuff, like, it still means a lot. So I just want to say I commend you on the changes that you're making too, and the struggles you're overcoming too.
Yeah, well, thanks. And I mean, sometimes it is a little bit about showing people what you can do. I mean, when I ruptured my quad tendon in, I had surgery in early November. Doc said, you're not going to do anything till May. Well, I was running in January, in fact, skied that spring, but I was in the Leadville 100 that summer. And
oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, coming from where the point where I wasn't even supposed to be starting to run until May. And so my crew was my high school cross country team. And so I ended up being the last finisher of the race. I came in 29 hours and 58 minutes. And but the whole time I was thinking, I want these kids to see what is possible. The fact that you can overcome something as, you know, a quad rupture is way worse than, you know, an ACL or anything like that. Joke with people that ACLs are, that's a sissy injury by comparison. I mean, I know it's pretty serious, but still, I mean, you know, my leg was in a straight leg brace for 6 weeks and, you know, was basically a peg leg, you know, starting all over again. But I was so determined. I wanted to make sure those kids saw me finish the 100 miles and it was going to count. You know, I mean, it doesn't count if you come into 30 hours and 1 minute. So, I pushed myself through that whole thing. I barely remember half of the last few miles there. I was in such incredible pain at that point. But, wanted to show those kids it is possible to not only do 100 miles, but come back from something pretty catastrophic in the knee.
100%, man. That's awesome, man. Congratulations on that. Like, that is an incredible story. And yeah, that's inspiring to me. Like, and I think that's amazing. Like, that is just as inspiring as someone who, you know, battles their own demons, whatever that might be, like alcoholism, addiction, weight, anything like that, man. Like, I think anyone who can make a change, that's an inspiring thing. And you made the change, like, coming off of, you know, very unfortunate situation with that too. And I think that's super inspiring, man. So
yeah,
super,
thanks, man.
Super proud of you. Yeah. And quick pause here too. Just a heads up. I do have another call in 5 minutes. So I just wanted to give you just a heads up on time. Apologies like too for not mentioning that earlier, but I was just
no worries.
Time. I was like, oh yeah, I know I have an 11 o'clock here. So just wanted to give you a heads up on that. Sorry about that.
Yeah, no worries. I was going to ask you about Cocodona coming up because talking about stretching things out there, but just real brief, you've got a bunch of races coming up that are designed to kind of challenge you and work you towards that golden ticket, right?
Yeah, 100%. And it's like, it's interesting because like those, the golden ticket definitely is still the goal, but like, I still want to like gain experience. And so a lot of my kind of shift of being a coach is like, how do I gain more experiences as a coach to like help as many athletes as possible? Because like basically my A race for the past 2 years has been Javelina 100, which has been, it's a pretty flat race. You know, it's not that technical terrain. Like it's a very, very, very fast kind of race. And I wanted to kind of push the limits a little more. I'm like, what I could gain from an experience perspective to help my athletes. Now, I truly believe that, like, you know, I can help someone train for a 200 mile race today, and I could help someone train for like a very, 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 very mountainous ultra today. But like, I truly think that like having that personal experience is very, very beneficial as a coach. So like for me, that's like why I did Cocodona this year, is because like I want to have that personal experience to help athletes who are going for a 200 mile race. And that's why I'm also doing URAY 100, because like that race has more climbing than Cocodona in more than half the distance, or less than half the distance. And I've never done a race like that before. Like I've never done a race that's like up, down, climb, climb, climb.
Right.
And I was like, I want to gain that experience. And so for me, it's all about like, how can I put myself through these experiences to help more athletes, not just through coaching, but through the podcast as well, to be better endurance athletes. And so like, that's been more of a driving force to me than just like, because again, like why I'm going for the golden ticket is because I want to inspire other people. And so like why I'm going after these races, it's not like, you know, I want to see what I can do, because like, not to say that like, you know, I haven't found my limit, but like for me, it's like that question has kind of been answered for me. It's like, I know I can set anything I do my mind to. Like for me, it's more so like, I want to like gain the experience and the knowledge and put myself through things to help people who want to put themselves through those things. So like, it's like a lot of times people say like, oh, I'm going to 200 miles. Cause like, I'm trying to see like how far I can push it and like, blah, blah, blah. Like, and that's fine. Like, I'm not making fun of that or anything. It's just more so like that's like not my drive to like see what I'm capable of. It's more so like, how can I learn and share these experiences? Like that's like the bigger drive for me. Now in the moment, yes, it's very much like, oh, like I need to like become like this person about myself in the moment. But like why I'm doing the Cocodona and all that stuff is to learn and share the lessons.
Yeah, no, that's so cool. And I'm just amazed that 200 mile races and plus have become a thing now. It's, you know, I mean, I know how bad it feels to run 100 milers, but 200 mile races is just kind of out there. It's great. So it's great you're putting yourself out there doing that. And you're going to love Ouray, by the way. It's absolutely gorgeous there in Southwest Colorado. It's absolutely beautiful course out there. So thanks for sharing all that. Thanks for sharing all of this, Joe. And, you know, really appreciate what you're doing, helping people out with their own running goals, their life journeys, and what you do with the Everyday Ultra podcast. Like I say, love the mix of topics and guests you have.
Oh, that's awesome. I appreciate that, man. Well, I appreciate you listening and all the good words. And yeah, right. I'm just stoked about ultra running, and that's why I do what I do, man. So I appreciate that a ton.
Yeah. Well, you know, I know you got to run here, not literally, but it's great to connect with a New Yorker, Pennsylvania college guy, whatever. And where can people continue to find you out there?
Yeah, 100%. And thanks again for having me on, man. So best place to find me is the Everyday Ultra podcast. You can listen to it on any platform, Apple, Spotify, anything like that. We post episodes every week to help you be a better endurance athlete every day. And I'm also on Instagram at Joe Corcione. And if you are interested in coaching and work with me to help you crush your next ultra marathon, you can send an email to me at everydayultrapodcast@gmail.com. Just let me know if you want to talk about coaching and everything like that, and I'd be happy to help and always willing to help you crush your next ultra. And even if you have any questions, just let me know and I'll be more than happy to help.
And that's great how generous you are with your advice and insights. And in the 1 minute or so here, what can somebody do every day to improve themselves in ultra runner, turning it around on you?
Yeah, 100%. The biggest thing is be consistent, like be consistent every day. Doesn't just like run every day. It means do something that's going to make you a better endurance athlete. So that could be going out for your run. That could be going easier when you should be going easier. That could be nailing your long run. That could be, you know, doing the strength training. That could be taking the recovery, sleeping well. It's whatever. If you're doing one thing every single day that's going to help you be a better endurance athlete and being consistent with that, that's going to help a ton. So, I'm just so excited for everybody to crush their ultra running goals. And that's the biggest piece of advice I can give.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to add to that. Train with grit. You know, you've got to be able to deal with the adversity. You know, if you're going to run at night, run with your headlamp. If you're going to, you know, you can't face adversity unless you've been through it in training. So train with grit. Train with every, you know, go out in the bad weather, go out on the tough trails, run through the mud. You know, you're not going to do well in a muddy race if you haven't run in the mud in training. So train for grit, and that will get you ahead too.
I love it. I love it. Train with grit is amazing. Well, awesome, Bill. Well, thanks for having me on the podcast, man. I appreciate it. This was awesome. Let me know when this goes live. I'm happy to share it, and we'll be in touch, okay?
Will do. Thanks, buddy. I appreciate this so much.
Yeah, appreciate you too.
I'm sure you felt Joe's seemingly boundless energy, and I hope you enjoyed learning from Joe as much as I did. What was amazing is that we set up this chat in the run-up to and following his wedding. Now, there's a guy who can cram a lot into his schedule. So again, drop me a message at silly_billy@msn.com or on Facebook or Instagram messengers if you might be interested in being one of the inaugural 10 individuals in the Be Positive Runners community. And thank you to Joe, and thanks to all of you again for listening to the We Are Superman podcast. Hey, make sure you subscribe so you can load all new episodes onto your phone. And if you enjoy the podcast, the best thing you can do is share it with your friends or on social media. And please do me a favor and take 60 seconds and give us a 5-star rating on whatever platform on which you listen to us. I would also be humbly honored if you would write a review as well. These 5-star ratings and reviews really do help us make more episodes and rise higher in the podcast services search algorithms, helping more people find our show. Until next time, always be positive.